Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about writing. Tonight I have with me in the studio Barbara Serinella. She was an auto mechanic for 20 years and writes a mystery series with a lady mechanic with past. She's the author of two novels, the latest of which is called No Offense Intended. And I want to read from a review that was in the Chicago Tribune about her latest book, No Offense Intended. And I'm just going to excerpt it. And it says, "Certainly it's not Miranda Munch Mancini's profession that sets her apart. Who's to say an auto mechanic can't also be an amateur PI? Or that we haven't seen former substance abusers solving crimes between AA meetings, Matthew Scudder being the prime example. No, what's fascinating here is Barbara Serinella's ability to paint in several shades of gray as she forces Mancini to walk the razor's edge between her past life as a biker's moll and her desire to remain sober." A little later on in the review it says, "Serinella herself, a former Brentwood auto mechanic, keeps the storyline moving at a brisk pace with surprises around every corner. What's most impressive, though, is her seeming determination not to populate Mancini's world with cardboard heroes and villains or offer her deeply flawed characters easy solutions to those problems." Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Barbara.
Glad you could be here again.
Good to be here.
Barbara was here some time ago talking about her first book, No Human Involved, and so we will be... No doubt talking about some things that we touched on back then. For listeners who are new to the show, we love our listeners. I so enjoyed No Offense Intended, and Munch Mancini, your protagonist, is an auto mechanic and a recovering addict, resisting temptation and trying to keep her life on track. How much of Munch's character do you derive from your own past?
Well,
you have a very colorful past.
When I first started writing, I had a neighbor who was taking film classes at UCLA, and to find a plot, his teacher suggested that he take a blank piece of paper and write down events that changed his life. And my things I wrote down at first were my divorce, childhood. I mean, very generic things that affect everybody. It took me a while to dig down to the other layers. Like, well, how about kicking heroin? That was sort of an interesting period. And then after that, to keep with that edginess of the first book that everybody loved, how about that first year of sobriety when I was trying to figure out how to live in the straight world after never having lived there? Mm-hmm. I mean, I left home and started living in the Haight-Ashbury at 14, so I never went to high school, much less college. Much less ever have a regular job. I once knew someone with a checking account, and I thought that was really bizarre. You know, I mean, I was really impressed that someone had a checking account. So here I get a regular job as an auto mechanic in an ARCO station in Sherman Oaks, and it was 10-hour-a-day work days, 6 days a week. Third Saturday of the month we always had off, and it was the longest weekend. I didn't know, you know, I'd clean my house, I'd wash my car, and then what do you do with yourself?
Mm-hmm.
So this, I drew from that period of time, and what happened was, when I was about 6 months sober, the son of one of my girlfriends, one of my best friends, who I'd helped raise, this boy, was going to turn 7, and they were living up in Oregon. And I thought, you know, it would just be right, it would be a Christian thing for me to do, to travel up there to Oregon and wish that kid a happy birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind that two of my girlfriends were living up there, drinking and using, and I'm flying away from my safe environment into unknown territory to see the little boy. And this is where the book goes, that adventure.
Interesting. Yeah. How did the character of Munch come to be?
Well, originally I wrote a short story, and I had met this woman that was on trial for killing her sugar daddy. And it was kind of a funny story, I thought, how she got caught, and I thought that would make a funny short story with this ironic twist ending.
Mm-hmm.
And she was small. So my first image of Munch is this small woman. And then I put a lot of the things that happened to me into her. And I also had, like, her mother, who died of an overdose, is drawn from a character who I knew in Venice, total bohemian. I mean, never learned how to drive. The woman is 70 years old. She's never lived in Los Angeles all her life, never learned how to drive, and has gotten by with that. And grew up in the beatnik era of Venice and lived across the street from Jim Morrison, you know, and just, and raised two kids in Venice Beach. And so that's who I thought of as her mother, and what a child from her, what their life was like.
Well, are there things from your past that you refuse to put in your books?
No, not really. I really try to dig deep and go as deep as I can, really, and just tell all my secrets. I've had Munch have lived in Venice all her life, and so I had years up in the Haight-Ashbury in the early 70s, which can't be in this series with Munch, which is too bad, because those were some interesting times also.
How would you describe the overall theme of your work?
The overall theme? Give me an example of theme.
Well, you know, what did Phil say last week when I asked him about the theme of his work? He said how revenge ultimately can hurt yourself.
He would be able to answer that question, wouldn't he? Mike, you know what? I really like that Chicago Trip review because it was so glowing, but also he said that line that she doesn't give her characters easy answers. And the theme of No Offense Intended was all these children being raised, they're not being sexually abused, but they're not having good childhoods either. Mm-hmm. And what can you do for them? You can't take, they're not getting beaten, but, you know, they're sleeping, they're wearing wrinkled clothes, and mom is pretty distant, or she's on the couch swaddled in blankets watching TV while they do whatever they want. You know, and I saw so many kids like that, and there was so little I could do for them. And that, so that was sort of an ache that permeates the book.
How about reading a bit?
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay.
The book is right behind you there.
Let me hand you mine, and here it is.
Okay, this is No Offense Intended, edited for radio.
Thank you.
We have this online site, MysteryNet, and they have the first chapter, and people can discuss it. And this woman said, you had to say the S word in the first paragraph, so I just had to put it down. I thought, I wrote back, I says, ma'am, it's a plumber and an auto mechanic. The S word had to come up. I'm sorry. So we'll substitute something acceptable.
Good.
Chapter 1. No offense, the plumber began. Munch sighed. Why did people always feel the need to warn you before they said something stupid? She looked up from the carburetor she was working on and gave the man in the stained overalls her full attention. But don't you think that working on cars is kind of, I don't know, unfeminine? She lifted out the float assembly on the quadrajet. Yeah, I worry about it all the way to the bank. What kind of gas do you burn in this thing? Whatever, he said. Why? She shined her drop light into the float chamber. You're full of crap here, she said, keeping her face straight, knowing this double entendre would be lost on this Neanderthal. It was 1977, for God's sake. Didn't he realize that Barefoot and Pregnant went out with the 60s? This is going to take at least a half a day, she said. In fact, it would be better if you left it overnight. She looked over his shoulder and spotted Happy Jack, the owner of Happy Jack's Auto Repair. Hey, Jack, you want to write this guy up? He needs a carb overhaul. Jack grabbed a clipboard and headed their way. You got a visitor, he said, jerking his thumb over his shoulder. Her boss's expression told her that he didn't approve. She followed his gaze and understood why. Munch's visitor leaned against the fender of a blue Chevy pickup. The truck was fairly new, a 74 model, perhaps even a 75. Sleaze was doing well, it seemed. His mother had named him Jonathan Garrido, but on the street he was known as Sleaze John. The last time she'd seen Sleaze was when he was driving for Sunshine Yellow Cab out of Venice. That was a year ago, in another life. Driving a cab had been just a vehicle for Sleaze's other various vocations. Pulling cons on tourists, ripping off dopers trying to score, running numbers for bookies unwise enough to trust him. Thanks, Jack, she said, climbing down from the milk crate she stood on when she worked on trucks. This won't take long. Leaving Jack to ride up the plumber, Munch made her way over to where Sleaze waited. The truck's idle stumbled as she drew closer. The bearded stranger in the passenger seat glanced at her briefly and then looked away. She stuck her grease rag in her back pocket and approached them warily. What do you want? She said. What happened to hello? He asked. Hello, what do you want? You got a light? A Cheshire cat grin stretched his full lips. He was clean-shaven and a brunette this week, which complemented his even white teeth and thickly lashed eyes. There was a time when she had thought him quite the fox. She pulled out her lighter, automatically reaching for the pack of Camels in her shirt pocket. With her lighter in his hand, he pointed to her cigarettes and, almost as an afterthought, asked her for a smoke. Same old sleaze. She shook her head, wondering what this visit would cost her. He lit both her cigarettes and exhaled a thanks. She caught his hand before her lighter disappeared into his pocket. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "I've missed you." "Sleaze." She glanced at the man riding shotgun, noting his long sleeves and dark sunglasses. A faded blue gel tattoo crossed the man's left jugular vein. She recognized the insignia of the Aryan Brotherhood, a pair of jagged lightning bolts that formed the letters SS. The man crossed his arms over his chest and rocked back and forth. The truck's idle stuttered again and then resumed an even pace. "Hear that?" Sleaze asked. "What do you think that is?" "If you want work done, you're going to have to leave it. I'm backed up right now," she said, aware of Jack hovering protectively just out of earshot. "I'm in kind of a hurry, too," he said. He looked around, then dropped his voice. "Actually, I'm in a little bit of a jam." Munch noticed that the gas cap of the truck was painted blue. She reached out and touched it. The surface was tacky. She leaned in the open window and saw the ignition wires dangling under the dash, their insulation stripped and two of them twisted together. The passenger moved a hand to his cheek and kept it there. The gesture was fine with her. She didn't want to remember him either. She pulled the rag from her back pocket and carefully wiped off all the surfaces she remembered touching. "I don't want any part of this. I could get revoked for just talking to you." "Since when did you pay attention to court orders?" he asked. "Since I got a year suspended. I've changed, Sleaze. Don't mess this up for me." He appraised her from under half-closed lids. "Yeah, I heard you got religion. I'm real proud of you. Are you happy?" "Yes, of course." The words came out too quickly. He raised an eyebrow, making him look a little like Clark Gable. Had he picked up the defensiveness in her tone? "You look really good. I was going to say something." She snorted. "Spare me. You want to do something nice for me? Just get out of my life." She kicked the tire of the truck. "And take this with you." "Hey, don't be like that. We've got too much history." "Forget it. It's like you said, history. What happened and what didn't happen was for the best. Neither one of us wanted to be dragging a kid around." She looked at his face to confirm that this was the truth, but she couldn't read him. "Aren't we at least friends?" he asked. "I never had friends, Sleaze, just using partners." She looked pointedly at his travel companion. "So that's it, huh? The rest of us are just crap on your shoes?" His tone and expression were accusatory, like she was some sort of traitor to the cause. But there was no cause, she thought angrily, just a bunch of loaded idiots trying to justify their existence. "I'm just trying to tell you that I've got something good going here," she said. "I don't want to mess it up." "I'm not looking to mess you up. I have a disease, John. I have to be careful." "What are you talking, disease?" "I'm in remission from alcoholism and drug addiction. I can't be around anyone still using." How could she make him understand? She wasn't sure herself. She was spouting program dogma at him, all the tools of defense she had learned. Maybe it would be easier if he just got mad at her. "And that's how you want it?" he asked. "That's the way it has to be." "What about Deb?" he asked, "and Boogie? I thought he was your Ace Boone coon." "I haven't heard from them in almost a year. I don't even know where they are." "They're up in Canyonville." "Where's that?" "Oregon. Pretty country if you don't mind rain." This news made her pause. She made it, huh? Moving to the country had been their mutual dream. The country was a place for fresh starts, cleaner living, a good place to raise Boogie. "You got a number for her?" Sleaze reached into his pocket and drew out his wallet. "Just a sec. You got a pen?" She handed him her pen. He walked over to the counter and picked up several of the shop's business cards. Behind her, Jack frowned. Sleaze flipped one of the cards over, wrote the word Snake Pit, and copied down a number from his wallet with an Oregon area code. "She doesn't have a phone at her house," he said, "but you can usually reach her here." "Snake Pit?" "It's a bar in Canyonville." "Is she doing all right?" "She's got an old man." "Well, there's a surprise. Deb always had an old man. She always fell passionately in love with each of them and cried buckets when they left." Munch envied her that, her depth of passion. "He's an idiot," Sleaze added. Her face twisted in a wry smile. They were always idiots, especially after Deb was done with them. "I did some business with him," Sleaze said. "He tried to get over on me. Uh-huh. She didn't need to ask for any particulars. Nothing he said or she asked would move the conversation any closer to the truth. Sleaze had a way of explaining things that neatly sidestepped any culpability on his part. The other guy was always wrong, and usually a step too slow. I have to get back to work. Just tell me what you want, Sleaze. He glanced back nervously at his companion in the truck. Like I said, I'm in a little bit of a jam. Nothing serious. It should blow over soon. And I'm supposed to do what? She asked. I just wanted to see you, he said, watching traffic as if he were waiting for something. It's been so long. He reached over and touched her cheek. Too long. She pulled back. It was time to end this exchange. He wasn't the first to come around from her old life. She'd found a simple formula for getting rid of the others, her ex-using partners, who had somehow managed to sniff her out, sensing some prosperity not their own that might be available for leeching. They'd come to her with hard luck stories, told with sorrowful faces and sincere tones. Maybe they thought getting clean and sober had somehow affected her memory, that she wouldn't spot their game since she was no longer on the pitching side. She had learned that it was easier to indulge them, listen to their baloney, and agree about the unfairness of the world. Then she'd loan them money, sometimes at 20, she'd gone as high as 50. And they would promise to pay her back as soon as they got on their feet. The ones who owed her never came back. The money she lent was a small price to pay to ensure that they wouldn't return. How much would it take to get out of this jam, she asked, reaching for her wallet. She carried her wallet in her back pocket, like a man would. Maybe the plumber was right. She looked over in his direction and found Jack watching her. He tapped his watch. I've got to get back to work, she said. Sleaze saw her go for her wallet. He probably wasn't even aware that he had licked his lips. I've got a kid, he said, a little girl. She felt a lightning bolt streak between her gut and heart. He always knew how to find the soft spots. Hadn't he been the one who taught her how to isolate the mark and single out the vulnerabilities? She tried to think if there any way he could know about the scarring within her body, how it had rendered her infertile. She had spoken of it at meetings, so it wasn't exactly privileged information. But the meetings that she attended were here in the San Fernando Valley. Had he somehow heard? Good for you, she said. Who's the mother? Karen. That broad who worked at the phone company? Another mark, Munch remembered. Karen was always good for a 20 that Sleaze would collect on her lunch break while Munch waited in the front passenger seat of the taxi with the meter off. Yeah, that's the one. She felt an uncomfortable flash of heat shoot up the back of her neck. It was time to play Name That Emotion. Emotions were a new thing, another dubious gift of sobriety. Before, they'd never been an issue. Before, if anyone had cared to ask at any given time how Munch was feeling or what she was feeling, she would only have had two possible answers, good or sick. Sobriety opened up a whole new range. Those first few months, her sponsor, Ruby, had driven her crazy, asking her how she was, what she was feeling. Finally, Munch had told her. She was angry. Then Ruby had patiently explained that anger wasn't an emotion. It was a reaction. Get past the anger, Ruby said. It was a shield, a coat of armor. Munch looked at Sleaze. He had a kid. He and Karen had a kid. How did that make her feel? She didn't have to think too long. Ruby said that one day maybe Munch might adopt. That was another of those nebulous in-the-future things that Ruby was always promising. Like getting married one day. Munch told her, yeah, that might happen. But first she needed a date. So what do you want from me? She asked. I want you to meet my kid, he said. And what about Karen? Karen's dead. She OD'd. His eyes clouded. If she didn't know better, she'd think he really felt bad. This realization annoyed her. More jealousy, she wondered. I've been staying in Venice, he said. You're going to laugh when I tell you where. He held up an oval rubber key fob with the number 6 stamped on it. A single door key dangled from the stainless steel ring. What, back at the flats? Many happy memories there. There's a few. You can't say there isn't. The truth is, I haven't been home in a few days. Too hot? She asked. He grinned that infuriating, I know I've been bad, but I'd probably do it again, grin at her. She had to fight herself to not respond with a smile of her own. How did he get his eyes to twinkle like that? So who's watching this kid of yours now? She asked. A neighbor. Does this kid have a name? She felt herself being sucked into his baloney. Forget the kid's name, she told herself. Forget misplaced loyalties to old running partners. She wasn't a part of that world anymore. The war was over. She had surrendered. Asia. Asia? She echoed, shaking her head. What kind of name was that? She turned to step away from him. She had work to do. She didn't need this crap. He followed her as she walked back to the Cadillac she'd been working on, the one with the leaking water pump. She was conscious of her walk and how it didn't wiggle. Steel-toed boots didn't lend themselves to sexy walking. Actually, he said, there is one other thing. I'm sure there is. She squeezed her arms around the radiator shroud of the Cadillac to get to the four bolts that held the fan on. She knew she would pay for this action later. Soap and water wouldn't completely wash out the bits of fiberglass that would embed in her arms. She'd be itching for days. Sleaze leaned over a fender, ingratiating himself under the hood. I just need you to take the baby over to my sister's and pick up a few things at the apartment. Mostly just the baby stuff. Clothes, her car seat, a couple toys. She paused, feeling that tug between two worlds, and thought about Venice Beach, the place that used to be home. Nostalgia filled her as she remembered all the old haunts, the boardwalk, the circle, Hooker Hill, Sunshine Cab. There was a time when she knew who she was and what she was about. Think harder, she told herself. Think about the misery attached to that old life, the running, the constant fear, the hopelessness. I don't go to Venice, she said. I'm not asking you to stay there, he said. Just a quick pit stop. You'll be in and out in 2 minutes. What about your sister? Have Lisa go to Venice. I'm kind of overextended with her, he said. You mean she's fed up with your nonsense? No, he said. The thing is, there's these guys. Don't tell me anymore. I don't want to know. She put her cigarette between her teeth to free her hands as she worked the ratchet. Smoke filled her eyes and she squinted, feeling her face scowl. She stopped working and threw away the butt. But you'll come? He asked, dangling the key. She looked at him for a long minute, framing a reply. You're my only hope, he said. Don't do me like that. I'm not anyone's only hope. I didn't get sober to keep digging losers out of holes. Whatever you've gotten yourself into, that's your problem. I can't get into any of that. You've changed. That's what I've been trying to tell you. He didn't used to be so cold. She wanted to say that that wasn't it. She was anything but cold. All her using career, she had wound her feelings into a hard knot and stored them in a place deep inside her, a place so dark and barren that nothing and no one could get to them. She had hoped that eventually all that was vulnerable would shrivel and die, free her from the pain of life. But it hadn't gone like that. Now she was going to live. She had to tread carefully. He would never understand that a reprieve was a daily thing, so instead she said nothing. Let him think what he would. The fender lifted slightly when he stood. Through the reflection of the caddy's windshield, she watched him climb into the cab of the truck and then shake his head like he was disappointed. He'd said something to his passenger, and the other guy nodded and said something back. It angered her. Who the hell did he think he was, passing judgment on her? He was the one who messed up, right? Her knuckles slammed into the cold steel of the engine blocks. The socket slipped off the bolt she was loosening. Now look what he'd made her do. She felt tears well up in her eyes. Feelings sucked. When she looked down, she saw he had left the key on the fender.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've just tuned in, this is Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and you've just heard Barbara Serinella reading the first chapter of No Offense Intended. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be chatting at length about Barbara's book. Stay tuned.
Come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow. Mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. know, little darling, one month better today. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hello again, we're back. Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm here with Barbara Serinella, and we're talking about No Offense Intended. I'm curious about beginnings. How did the beginning of this book come about? And do you know it when you have a beginning?
Well, I knew what time period I was going to write about, and I knew that she was going to get up to Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I did used to have people come into my work, and I, you know, when you're drinking and using with people, especially bikers, they're these romantic, dashing sort of pirate figures. And then when you get off the drugs and the booze, they're like, ew, they're fat and disgusting, and they shake, and they're dirty, and they smell. And so it was very embarrassing to have them come and see them in the light of day, and then mm-hmm. I'd just lend them money, and then they would go away. The beginning with the plumber actually happened to me, as I say, in my garage. So that was wonderful. And it's, you know, I'm always looking for an incident like that where and I think about how Munch would respond to that situation.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, she cleans a lot in this book.
Mm-hmm.
She cleans an awful lot. And you said earlier that when you started working as a mechanic and you were off drugs and getting clean, that you cleaned a lot. And I found that interesting. Also, that as I was reading the book, I sort of got my cleaning efforts at my house a little more together. It's like, well, she's cleaning. I need to clean. Okay. Very interesting.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it comes up a lot, and it's just sort of that way to get your own environment in order. You know, there's a saying in AA, it's actually part of the preamble, only when your own house is in order, you know, can you give. So make sure your own house is in order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What sort of research do you do for your books?
Well, when possible, I go to the location and I walk around. I know with the first book, I went to Viona Creek because I knew this is where this body part was going to be discovered. And I had a wonderful day with this guy riding 10 speeds around the wetlands. And he was a journalist, and he knew the names of all the plants, and he knew the history of the area. And he just pointed all this stuff out to me, which was fantastic. Plus, I knew what kind of wildlife was around there, what the mm-hmm. smells were, what kind of things stuck in your socks. And on the third book, which is coming out at the end of this year, they go down to Tijuana. So I decided I really need to go down to Tijuana and get a refresher course in Tijuana. And fortunately, it hasn't changed since the first time I went to Tijuana. And we had a wonderful guide. It was this cop's sister who lived down in San Ysidro and his mother who didn't speak English. So my husband came along, and we crossed the border on sort of a misty day and got to see the Tijuana morgue and drive around the streets of Tijuana and see all the people with the dent hammers that want to fix your car and all the pharmacies and dental offices and the guys that tint your windows and Revolution, where all the mm-hmm. The bars are, and then the streetwalkers in front of the bars. And we even got a ticket, which was funny. I was in with the mother watching her bargain for some roses because she didn't speak English, but she was just fun to watch because she was this very stately doña with this big black patent leather purse, and she was picking out what she wanted, and I could see that they were going through the bargaining process. And the sister, Fina, ran in to where we were, and she said, oh, now you're going to see some authentic Tijuana because we're getting a ticket. And her eyes are shining, you know. And she says, and I don't have registration, so they want to tow the car. You know, I mean, you're thinking this is going to be pretty horrible. It's going to rain, and they're going to tow the car, and here we are in Tijuana. Anyhow, so the mother comes out and bargains with the cop. And my husband's in the back seat with his wallet. And the mother came and sat next to him, and he pulled a 20 out, and she shook her hand no. And he just held his wallet open, and she pulled a 10 out, and she crumpled it up, and she passed it out the window to this cop, who was happy to take it and let us drive on. And then the sister explained that they wanted $40 because there were four of us. So that was great. I got a great chapter out of that, you know, coming back across the border. Just everything I saw was just wonderful. You know, we even had this little boy run across the street and beg for our coffee. We were drinking coffee from Jack in the Box. You know, this is lukewarm, half-filled cups of coffee, and this kid is reaching for him. And it's, geez, you know, third world.
Mm. So it sounds like your experiences are all grist for the mill. I mean, are you consciously knowing that what you're doing or what you're going through might very well find its way into your book?
Yeah, and I kind of leave the plot open. So, for instance, I went to this club called the Spearmint Rhino, where it's an adult cabaret, and mm-hmm. I talked my way in because I said I was scouting location for this character to work there, and I wanted to see what it was like. So I got to talk to one of the dancers. I almost got a free lap dance at a $50 value, but then she decided it might gross me out, so she didn't do it. I was open to it, you know. They dance naked. The guy has to leave his clothes on. And I said, hey, I saw that it has a dress code as you come in. I said, I saw in the dress code that the men have to keep their shirts tucked in. Are you worried about weapons? And she said, this is a gentleman's club. Oh, please. Anyhow, it was terrific. So she told me stories about what it was like working there and what she did, and a story about a girl getting killed. And it was wonderful. I just wrote a chapter from that. And, you know, I didn't know what she was going to tell me. I didn't even know if I was going to get into this place. But I used to see the billboards on the freeway, Spearmint Rhino. And I thought, what a great name, mm-hmm. Adult Cabaret. It just tickled me. So I had to go check it out, you know.
Multiple viewpoints. You use them in your books.
Yes.
And I'm curious about the advantage to using them. Is it because you want to go into different characters' heads and write the story from how they see it, or is it for suspense, increasing suspense, or is it just because you like to read books like that?
Yeah, when I open a book and I see that it's first person, I usually am sort of disappointed, like, ugh, you know, because I think that's sort of limited. Now, I have read good books first person. Mm-hmm. Now, also, I am, you know, pulling my guts out to write this stuff. And it gives me a little bit of distance to be able to say, this is what this character did. If I was saying, I did this, mm-hmm. it would be too personal. I don't know how deep I could go with it. But since it's another character doing mm-hmm. it. And also, I want things to happen off stage that Munch doesn't see as
right.
part of the plot.
Mm-hmm. To what extent do you outline your stories, your novels?
Well, I know, I have a good idea, certain key scenes, and how it's going to end. You know, I have the advantage of writing a mystery that, well, we know that there's going to be a murder. We know that there's going to be suspects. We know that by the end of the book, the killer will be revealed and brought to justice. So, the structure is there, and that's mm-hmm. kind of nice. Whereas you were writing just a regular novel, you know, mm-hmm. what is the point of all this? So the genre, you know, saves you from that. Yeah, it's that built-in structure.
Mm-hmm.
But I know in my third book, a cop told me a story of something. He said another cop did. It was probably him, but he didn't want to mm-hmm. say it was him. I liked it, and I thought, I'm going to end the book that way. So I knew. I didn't know how they were going to get there, mm-hmm. but I knew that was going to be the ending. So it was kind of nice.
So in terms of your plot, do you have an idea of what the plot points are going to be or what the climax, or it sounds like with this one you had the ending, you had the resolution
mm-hmm.
or something that was in the ending, but is it a path of discovery for you as you're writing
your
book?
Yes, absolutely, and I think it's more fun that way too, because I'm like 60 pages into a book right now, and you know, when you sell a book, you write a synopsis, and it's basically kind of just saying what's happened in the first 60 pages, I've noticed, because I really don't know what's going to happen next. I know who got murdered, and I know what the obstacles are for the protagonist and her sidekick. How they're going to overcome those obstacles and who the murderer is will have to be revealed to me as we get to know all the other characters in the book.
Mm-hmm. What is it about the mystery genre that interests you?
Well, originally I started writing No Human Involved because I knew the criminal subculture side so well. Mm-hmm. And I just had to learn about the cop side. So, you know, you write what you know. So I had that advantage of knowing a lot of inside information other people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my strength, I felt. Mm-hmm. And then once I got into the mystery, I found out what a great world it is, a support from fans and readers and bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm going to write this series.
Mm-hmm. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Barbara Serinella about No Offense Intended and about No Human Involved. The titles to your books, the first one, No Human Involved, did it just come out? Did it?
Well, I can't.
And then did the second one follow because of the no?
Yeah, the first, when I heard this expression that cops use, no human involved, referring to cases where, you know, when they had their police code, they'll say, we have a human versus animal, you know, case, you know, or something. So, in this case, it's AVA, which is, we'll say rectum versus rectum, and then no human involved. That was their little code thing to refer, they say AVA, NHI. So when I heard that expression, no human involved, I loved it. And I said, that's a great title. It was a gift. So originally, this title was going to be the 14th step. In AA, you know, you always hear there's a 12-step program. The 13th step is when you go out and have sex with a newcomer to bring them in. And the 14th, and they'd say, you know, if someone is messing around with someone who's really new to the program, and they say, oh, he's 13-stepping her or whatever. Well, the 14th step is when you go out with a newcomer and use with them and then bring them back. So kind of a joke because you break your own sobriety for the sake of getting them sober. Anyhow, that was a little vague. And then, as I say, I was into the book, and then that thing happened with the plumber, and I thought, oh, that would have a lot of resonance. Yeah. No offense.
What is the title to the third book?
Unwanted Company. And my publisher's like, not another no title, and I could not. It's, Munch has a limo company, which I had a limo business, and that was an unwanted company. Then she has a friend. It's 1984. She's 7 years sober, and she has a friend get out of jail and look her up, and that's sort of unwanted company. And then there's a character who's a CIA agent, because the Olympics were going on. There were all these CIA agents in Los Angeles watching all the diplomats and stuff, and there's a Romanian diplomat. So that's unwanted company. And then when I started working on the fourth book, I have this character, Ellen, who's Munch's sidekick, who is not quite sober yet and kind of capable of anything, which is kind of fun because she's Munch Unleashed, so she's fun to write about. And Munch says, no man's going to get the best of us. And Ellen says, no man standing. So that's the title of book four,
oh,
No Man Standing.
That's good. The voice of the character of Munch has so much, is so, I don't know, her way and the rhythm of her speech is very much how I hear you in terms of how you talk. And the writing is so straightforward and unadorned, and I'm curious if your writing has always been this natural or if it's something you've had to work at.
Definitely something I had to learn. I took a lot of writing classes at UCI, and I read a lot of books on writing, and they all stressed, you know, getting rid of adjectives and adverbs, using those turbo verbs, you know, getting away from the to be, writing crisp, clean sentences. I was just in a writing conference in San Diego, and the guy was a teacher, Richard Lederer. He writes for Writer's Digest, and he would always assign his students to write an essay using only one-syllable words. And then he read an example of this essay, and it was so powerful. It was so great. It was amazing. You know, so they always say, don't use 50-cent words when there's a good 10-cent word or good 5-cent word. So it was definitely something I learned to do, and I liked the way it sounded.
Which reminds me of something one of my students once said. She thought that her lack as a writer had to do with her vocabulary not being huge. You know, that she didn't have these 50-cent words to throw around. And I said, no, it's not about that.
No, it's not.
It's the language of and the simplicity.
I mean, I love words, and I love how words sound. I love hearing a new word. I love hearing a word that specifically means something, that they have a word for it, you know. And I'll look up a word. I'll thumb through a dictionary and just look at words. But definitely it is the strength of detail and description that makes for good writing, not the vocabulary.
What is the key for you to writing good suspense? Is it something you're conscious of as you're going through your book?
Pacing is important. Things have to happen. You don't have a lot of backstory. You don't take time to explain how someone came to be somewhere or who they are, where they were born or raised or any of that stuff. You let it come out in snippets in the dialogue and how they act. I mean, how Munch would handle a situation. I mean, Munch is sitting in a dentist chair, and she's thinking about stealing the tools because they would be good for working on a car. I mean, you know, what other character thinks of it that way? Mm-hmm. Or a cop looks at a scene, he sees it with a totally different perspective than a layperson would. Mm-hmm. So you let the character be revealed in action rather than in long drifts of exposition.
Mm-hmm. What is your process like? People always want to know this. Do you write for a set amount of time every day, or is it when it hits you? Is there a particular time of day?
I'm best in the morning. I heard once someone saying, well, you know, I'm a creative person, so I never feel like I've done enough creatively in a day. And I thought, oh, I didn't know that was an affliction we all had.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like 1,000 words, which is about 4 pages, is a good day. And that includes reading what I've already written and rewriting it. I write longhand in a free writing group once a week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a critique group. I'm in several critique groups where I get feedback on my work. And it depends. If I'm near the end of the book and I know where I'm going with it, it's very hard to do anything else. I'll be like, I'm going to come make dinner, honey, and I want just one last spell check, and an hour passes. I'm really bad about that. I don't need the discipline to sit down. I need to...
Right. Discipline to end.
Yeah.
So your first drafts are longhand?
Well, not the whole first draft. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. I mean, I get some good stuff out of those writing freestyle, and sometimes I incorporate it. Sometimes I'll go back and remember something I wrote and incorporate it later.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real mix, you know, of things. You know, obviously it's fun to write it on the computer first time. You get to move stuff around. You get to check the spelling, you know.
Mm-hmm. You wrote 3 novels before your first novel.
Yes.
No Human Involved. And you said that you didn't try to sell them. Why is that?
Well, I wrote the one novel before I took any writing classes, and I figured I'd written 80,000 words. I had something to sell. And I queried a couple agents and got the form responses, and then I took a writing class, and nobody said, this is great. They said, nice writing, but where's the story?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the theme? Where's the thread? Where's the character growth? You know, oh, I didn't, you know, all new terms to me.
Mm-hmm.
So then I said, well, the problem is there's 2 stories going on in this one novel, so I'll pull it apart and write the 2 novels that are really in here. So I write one novel with cardboard characters and stereotypical Nazi bad guys and everything, and about a time frame, World War II, that I only knew about from books. And then I wrote another book about this lady mechanic going through this, you know, horrible divorce. Boring, you know, not to me because it was me, but I did learn how to hone my skills that way. And then I sat down and wrote 100 pages of a science fiction novel because I love science fiction. Then I realized you have to be a scientist to write this stuff. So I abandoned that, thinking I'd come back to it, and I started writing No Human Involved, and that just came out in 6 months, and it was great, and I knew it was great.
Hmm.
70-year-old men loved it. 20-year-old girls loved it. I knew I had something, mm-hmm. you know, and I sold it really fast.
Did you know as you were writing it that you were onto something?
Yeah, because I was in a critique group where people were just going, you wrote that? This is fantastic. I remember one time coming to the group and we had new members and they thought a man had written it. And I thought that was a really big compliment because, you know, they just got mailed the pages. They read them ahead of time because there's a man's point of view
mm-hmm.
in there too.
Mm-hmm. Does your husband read your work in progress?
I read it out loud to him. He's not very good with reading. He'll skip and just read the last sentence in every paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
But he does ask me to read the stuff to him. So I follow him around the house reading it to him. He's kind of a hyperactive sort of guy, you know, so that's the way it works. Go read it to him in the jacuzzi and he starts washing the ants off the side. It's like, just sit still and listen, you know. Give him a cigarette and a glass of wine. Now listen, you know.
Let's talk about some of the business aspects of writing.
Okay.
First of all, agents.
Mm-hmm.
You now have Sandy Dykstra, who's powerhouse of an agent.
Mm-hmm. Just ask her.
And she was on the show a few times ago, and she was quite wonderful. And you had a different, less powerful agent for your first book. Now, how important is it, do you think? I mean, you sold your first book anyway
mm-hmm.
Without having a huge, powerful agent.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference here?
Well, I don't know how it would have gone if I had had Sandy on the first book. I had St. Martin's published my first book and gave me a very small advance and no real publicity support. But because it was a small print run, all the collectors in the mystery world got really excited about it, and that generated its own buzz. So it's like everything happens for a reason. Then I gave this agent those two books I wrote in the interim, and I didn't like her feedback. She started going through a divorce. I felt like, oh my God, she doesn't know what she's doing. She'd never sold fiction before. And I felt very uncomfortable with my career in her hands. Mm-hmm. But, like, where's the loyalty? You know, she did sell the first book, and she was the first one to point out how hard she'd worked for me, you know. So it was like a divorce. It was really very messy trying to get shed of her, but I just had such an uncomfortable feeling that my future was in her hands, and mm-hmm. She knew what she was doing. And Sandy is so sharp. And she just has the ear of everyone. And when she gave me feedback, it was wonderful. She improved the book a lot before we sent it out. And, she got me a great deal. And she will argue on my behalf. She goes way beyond what an agent would have to do. I mean, she edits. She's into the promotion aspect. She talks you up when she goes somewhere. So
oh, great.
Yeah.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. In terms of sales, what do you find is important? Are signings important? Are reviews important? Is it word of mouth? Is it being on a show, whether radio or TV?
You know, Amazon.com posts your sales rank. Mm-hmm. I don't know if other authors have talked about this. When I get on Amazon.com and I see the sales rank of, no offense intended, dip to 7,000, I knew something had happened. Then we found out the Chicago Tribune review had broken. No Human Involved went into paper, was in paperback same time as No Offense Intended came out. Sales rank was 700.
Wow.
Go to the mystery page, and they said new in paperback, No Human Involved. So people could go right to it. It's kind of cool. Signings are important just to get, you know, it's obviously you're not making up your gas money when you drive somewhere and you sign five books or you talk to a group of seven.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't do that, how are people going to know who you are and what you're writing?
Mm-hmm.
So I just do everything I can, and I don't know which ripple is doing the best, but, you know, I'm out there.
Mm-hmm. It's important just to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there anything that you've learned about publishing that's sort of different now being a published author as opposed to before you were? Any myths that were exploded once your books came out?
Yeah, I feel like the publisher and the editor are really on my side. I feel like we're all pulling for the same thing here. My editor, both of them, both women, very intelligent, very with it. And, you know, you always hear about the publisher, so, you know, put down, denigrated, I guess is the word. And that has not been my experience. They've been pretty wonderful. But, you know, it's a funny line you walk. It's like, you write a book and someone says, oh, well, it's an international aspects in it. You've got to be like Ludlam. Or, no, you've got a serial killer. You've got a Silence of the Lambs here. And it's like, but then you write something and they go, but that's been done. And then you do something that hasn't been done. And then it's like, well, this is a potential Silence of the Lambs. So you have to just be to thine own self be true and write the best book you can think of.
Mm-hmm. What are you reading now?
Oh, God, I just finished Lawrence Shames' Tropical Depression. He is so funny. I had it on tape because I was driving a lot. And he's just hilarious. And now I'm reading Blue by Abigail Paget. Mm-hmm. God, is she a wonderful writer. I just knew I'd feed my head with her. I'm enjoying that, too.
Any advice for the listeners?
That are writers?
Mm-hmm.
Or just about their life in general? Oh, God. I would say don't take the word of your friends and family. Get a critique group of people who aren't personally vested in you to read your stuff and give you an honest take on it. And don't listen to just one person. Get a group consensus. I think that's what helps me the most.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of your signings coming up.
Oh, well, I have two coming up in Orange County, and then I'm going up to Oregon and Washington. On Sunday, February 22nd, I'll be at Murder in the Gallery at 3 p.m. on 115 North Glassell in Orange. And then when I return from the Great Northwest, I will be in Laguna Beach on the 28th, which is another Sunday at 2 p.m., at Latitude 33, which is just a beautiful independent bookstore, mm-hmm. 311 Ocean Avenue.
And that's the 28th of February?
Yeah, and we'll have refreshments there, and we'll kind of make a party out of it since Laguna Beach is my hometown.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Anything else? What haven't I asked you?
I don't know. What do you want to talk about? How exhausting it is to be on tour. Right now, I'm trying to not be one of these obnoxious people who just blast out everything about themselves in their book. And then, you know, when I'm around friends and family, like, you know, I got brothers who just don't want to hear one more good thing about me. Thank you very much. So I'm trying to ask people about themselves and stuff, you know. But then when I go and do a TV show or a radio show or a panel or something, then you have to be on, and you have to talk about yourself.
Right.
And also, I'm like, oh, I'm just telling the same stories over again, but I'm talking about my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry it didn't change, so so I'm trying to find the balance there.
What about your parents? Have they read both of the books?
Yeah, they have read everything. They've read all the books.
What's their reaction?
Oh, the television interview I did today, they will never see. I had a woman ask me a question that sort of surprised me, and I didn't handle it very well. So I thought, fine, I just won't tell them when that show aired. Their reaction is they're very happy for me. They're very excited. My mother was very upset last night because a friend of hers went to a store in Santa Monica, and I wasn't on their computer, so she wanted to get to the bottom of that. So they're really behind me, and, you know, it's very fun for them because I take them to a lot of events, and mm-hmm. they meet a lot of famous people through me, and so we're having a good time with it.
Well, I'm sure happy you were here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. When your next book comes out, the end of this year,
yeah.
You come back.
I will.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, please email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. And if you or anyone you know would like to listen to my show or any show here on KUCI, and they have internet access, the address is www.kuci.org. I'll be here next week from 6 to 7 with Seattle literary agent Elizabeth Wales. And 2 weeks from tonight, Writers on Writing will broadcast live from Borders in Costa Mesa with Dennis McDougall. Same time, 6 to 7. And if you want to come on down there, please do. And be great to meet you. The music you have heard during the show is by Brian Barrett. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Chris is on next with music for Lunch Pails. Take care and thank you for listening. Now get to work and remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.